Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
There are two kinds of people in America: those who admit they're pretty ignorant about most of the laws and policies of this society, and those who are deluded into thinking they are not ignorant. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's a strong and pretty disheartening conclusion, but my guest will argue it does not mean we can't all learn and understand enough to make reasonable decisions in our own interest. The challenge for civic educators is figuring out what kind of information actually matters and then learning how to convey it to people who vote or will vote in the future. Arthur Lupia is Hal Arvarian Professor of Political Science and Research Professor at the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. His new book is called Uninformed: Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Arthur, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me, Chris.
So you're a professor of political science. You're often called upon to weigh in on government and laws and politics. I was fascinated by your admission that, if you're being honest, you know, and this is a quote, next to nothing about most of the laws and regulations and court decisions passed in the jurisdictions where you live.
Yeah, that's true. Last year, Congress passed about 200 laws, and the state legislature in Michigan passed about 200 laws, and my city passed about 100 ordinances. And, you know, I could name two or three, but, you know, on most of these things, I don't know about them. And it's ironic because I'm seen as one of the world's experts. I will admit to have read the Affordable Care Act, but most other laws I haven't read.
Could the same be said, do you think, about the lawmakers who are making decisions about these rules and laws and policies?
Yeah, but it has to be the case. I mean, lawmakers have so many things to do, so many demands on their time, that they just don't have time to become expert on a lot of topics. And so, like in Washington, for example, most congressmen have staffs who give them briefs on issues that on which they're about to vote. But the legislator themselves sees the brief, but they're not a deep expert on many of those issues.
So there will always be too much going on for any one person to be fully cognizant of every fact of things that are out there. How can we as individuals decide what we should be paying attention to? Can someone else decide that for us?
Yeah, well, what's fortunate about our democratic system is that for many of us, the task in front of us is pretty simple. So in many elections, you're asked to vote between two candidates or a small number of candidates. And so the key is not to know. I mean, it might be nice if you knew everything, if that were possible. But what the election day asks you to do is choose the best one out of two options. Now, a chimp with a coin can do that right, can get that right half the time. And so the question is, can we find little pieces of information that allow us to get the right answer? In many elections, we use political parties. Some people understand that there's a difference between Democrats and Republicans, and they might see that one party is closer to their values than the other. And that leads them to cast the same vote that they would have cast had they known a lot more. And so a lot of what politics is about is trying to find those little pieces of information that help people make the choices that they're asked to make.
Of course, political parties give us these cues, and we sort of assume that if we are, you know, on board with these three things, we'll probably agree with everything. But I'm curious as to whether you think that, you know, political parties are responding to what most of their constituents are interested in, or do the agendas of parties ultimately end up shaping the agendas of constituents?
Yeah, both of those things go on. I mean, parties have to be responsive to what voters want. A party that put together an agenda that had issues where voters thought they just don't fit together. If a party was saying things about, well, we have to grow the economy and we also have to have regulations on every conceivable human action, those two things don't make sense together. And so a party that tried to advocate that probably wouldn't get many supporters. So there is a sense in which parties have to be somewhat responsive. At the same time, many people don't pay a lot of attention to politics. There are so many other things in life that occupy people's time. And so some people are looking for somebody else to help them organize the world. And so parties play that role. And in some cases, you know, what a person really cares about is just one issue. That's the thing that consumes their lives. It's all they care about. And so, you know, if one party's strong on that, they might not necessarily care about the rest. So both of the things you mentioned are going on.
Is it ethical to be a one-issue voter?
Well, you know, It's very difficult in politics to regulate values. In fact, you might argue in a democracy that, you know, people expressing their values is a core part of what freedom is all about. And so, in the Constitution, you know, there's no restriction on the set of values that you can bring to the voting booth. So if one person, if it's all about abortion, if for another person it's all about military preparedness, and that's the thing for them, you know, we could argue that being part of a society, maybe they should care about other things, but that's a pretty slippery slope. So I think our system allows people to choose the values that they bring to the voting booth.
People love, as you know, Arthur, to be scandalized by those surveys that demonstrate how few of us can, for example, name our elected officials or name all the Supreme Court justices. Is it possible for a person to be well-informed and still fail those tests?
Oh, sure. And in fact, I would argue it's not just politics. It's any walk of life. You know, people drive cars. They drive them to work. They drive them for recreation. And if I were to ask basic questions about what propels a car, like how does a car actually work, people would do really badly on those tests. You know, we take airplanes. We fly across the country. We fly to see relatives. You know, what keeps a several-ton object in the sky for 8 hours? I mean, do people understand basic things? To bring it home, people have toilets in their houses, and most people couldn't answer a rudimentary quiz about how they work. But evidence suggests that most people know how to use them, right? And so with respect to politics, it's a lot of the same things. I mean, I think a closer example might be traffic lights. If we thought about an intersection where there were two lanes each way and they met at a certain point, and let's say at rush hour there are 60 people at that intersection, as an engineering problem, it's really difficult because what I'd have to know to get through that intersection alive is what are the intentions of the 59 other drivers and what are the speed and acceleration capacities of their car. That's a really complex problem to solve. And yet what most of us do is we look up in the sky and we see, is the red light or is it green? And if it's red, most of us stop. And if it's green, we tend to go. And people survive those intersections almost 100% of the time, despite the fact that as a technical matter, it's a very hard thing to do. So in politics, the key thing is, can we build the traffic lights, the brand names that help people make the same decisions they would have made had they known a lot more?
Of course, there's also the question, you know, it's one thing to think about the forthcoming election, right? And we use those traffic lights, we use those signals to try and have a sense of who we're voting for and what we're signing up for. But it would seem also to be a good idea to keep track of whether or not the people we put into office did the things they said we would do. Yeah. And, you know, as a journalist who doesn't regularly cover politics, I know it's a full-time job for the people who do.
Yeah, no, accountability is a big thing. And I think, you know, in our internet era, it's actually become easier to track what people are doing, to compare what they said when they were running for election for what they did. So for people, you know, for politics geeks and for people who are really interested in whether politicians keep their promises, there's no better time than our current period for that to happen. At the same time, the technology that allows that tracking to be available also produces things like Candy Crush and cat videos. And so where we might have the technology for greater accountability, we also have the technology for more distraction. And I think that's why the accountability story isn't as strongly told as we might think.
Everybody wants a silver bullet list of facts that would demonstrate competence.
Yeah.
But such a thing as it seems to fail in every area where people want a silver bullet.
Well, yeah, I mean, here's the problem with the small set of facts. There are so many people who are confident that if Americans just knew these three or four facts, then the country would be better off. The problem is that people don't agree on what the three or four facts are. And so if you take all the suggestions, you get a really long list that nobody can know. And if you try and find, okay, well, is there a common element to all their lists? There isn't any. Part of what happens in politics and part of what's always been true is politics is based on a combination of facts and values. It's not, people don't disagree about politics just because they disagree about facts. People disagree about politics because of, you know, differences in the morals and ethics that they have, whether they care more about the present or the future, the poor or the rich, foreign concerns or domestic concerns. And so, you know, if I really care about my city, I might say the most important things that people need to know are about what's going on in my city. And if you don't live in my city, you might say, why on earth would I need to know that? So these silver bullet lists tend not to exist. And when we try to force feed them to people, they ignore us or they nod and be polite while we're there. And then when they leave the room, they forget everything we said.
So is this what goes wrong with civics education in high schools?
Yeah, I wish I could say that it isn't, but this is a problem with civics education. Maybe when you and I were young, the eat your spinach approach, which is here are things you have to learn, and they're going to help you, you know, do politics in life. So what's your senator's name, and how long are they a term, and how many branches of government? You know, I wouldn't be caught dead not knowing them, given my job. But for many citizens, this just isn't information that they're going to use a lot. And so civics education that has the eat your spinach approach, it wasn't that successful in the 50s and 60s. And now, with all the competition for our attention, with all the other things that people can spend their time looking at, it is a less viable strategy than it was. So civic education has to change. People are changing it. My book describes ways that you can do it. But we really have to get people's attention first, present information in ways that make them interested and want to learn more. And then we've got a viable way to do civic education. But eat your spinach, if it ever worked, it's not working now.
Now, it starts with understanding what it is that people actually want to understand, which is not necessarily an easy thing to do if you are one teacher or one journalist.
No, it's very difficult, in fact. I mean, a common mistake that people make, and I say mistake, you know, I admire people who run campaigns or do civic education. So in the book, I'm very careful to say, I'm going to be critical. I love what you do. I want to support you. But there are some basic mistakes that are made. And one mistake is to say, well, me and people I know, there's a critical set of things we know. There's a critical set of experiences that we've had, and we're going to tell you about them to inspire you. The mistake there is most people aren't interested in hearing someone else's story. Most people are interested in hearing a speaker tell their story. So if I'm concerned about making it through the day, if I'm a parent concerned about taking care of my aging parents or my children, what I really want to hear is someone come in front of me and tell me how to get through my day and how to achieve my aspirations and how to deal with my fears or how government can help me do those. If a civic educator or a candidate can find a way to tell a story where the person in the audience says, that's my story, you understand me, you understand my fears and my anxieties, then you start to get an audience. But if they feel like you're lecturing or talking down to them, people tend to ignore you. And I think that a lot of what has happened in civic education is the lecturing approach rather than the let me try to find the intersection between what information I know will help you and what information you really want to hear.
Texas, as I'm sure you're aware, has a national reputation for arguing about the perspective from which history will be taught, which is not exactly what we're talking about here, but certainly related. How do we find the most effective ways to convey facts that will inevitably be interpreted through a political lens?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for 100 years in this country, not just in Texas, there's been a vigorous debate about how to teach history and how to teach civics. And to put this, simplifying it a little bit, but one camp is we've got to teach facts, and the other camp is critical thinking. And the fact is you need a little bit of both. If you teach just facts without critical thinking, people don't know how to use it. And if you teach critical thinking without facts, people don't understand the context in which they might be asked to act on things. So what I do when I teach people or when I advise people is really try to think about the prospective audience and create a situation where you are, create a moment where you're saying to a student or a prospective audience member, I understand what you want. I'm going to show you that I've listened to or that I've done some research, and I know why you're here, and I know what your aspirations are. And my job is not to lecture you. My job is to help you achieve your aspirations. And if that's the template, then I can provide a lot of information about politics, about policy, about history, and so forth that people will want to pay attention to. But I mean, for me, the mix, sometimes you think that when you're trying to prepare a lecture or a campaign, that the mix is 90% talking and 10% listening. But I think if you're doing that, it gets it wrong. I think the best way to put together an information campaign is 90% listening and 10% talking. And the listening is to try and figure out what types of information this person is ready to hear.
My guest is Arthur Lupia. He is professor of political science at the University of Michigan and author of a new book called Uninformed: Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. You can join this conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Arthur Lupia. He is professor of political science and research professor at the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. His new book is called Uninformed: Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. You can join us on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Arthur, of course, we all understand that, you know, democracy is really about the will of the majority. But there are important issues that affect minority communities particularly. What do we do about situations where maybe the majority of Americans don't feel that an issue is important, but in fact, not resolving it really infringes upon the rights of a small but significant percentage of the population?
Yeah, I mean, I think a critical thing is to try to help people see that there's some common values, that there's a common aspiration. I mean, the example that I talk about in the book, or at least one of them, has to do with same-sex marriage, right? And, you know, people have different points of view on that, and I respect that. What many advocates for same-sex marriage did until about 2009 was make an argument about, you know, that gay couples should have the right to marry because there are rights and benefits, right? There are all kinds of, you know, in terms of taxation, in terms of insurance, in terms of property ownership, inheritance, and things like that, that heterosexual couples have that homosexual couples did not have. And so that was the argument. And people did surveys in the late, let's say, 2009, 2010, saying, asking, you know, why do you think gay people want to get married? And they say, well, because they want rights and benefits. And say, well, why, you know, asking heterosexuals, why do you want to get married? They say, well, I want to be able to choose the person I love. When enough of these surveys were run and some experiments were run saying, well, what if, you know, the emphasis was on, you know, gay people being able to marry so they could choose who they love. They found that people who were kind of in the middle on this issue would say, oh, you know, I hadn't thought of it that way before, and they had changed their mind. And so if you compare the way that advocates were talking about this issue, let's say at the 2008 Democratic Convention with the 2012 Democratic Convention, it's night and day. Because in 2008, it's all about rights and benefits. And in 2012, it's all about the right to choose who you love. And so this is a case where you had a minority, gays and lesbians, and the way to try and get some people in the majority to think about them differently was to say, look, there's a similarity between them and you. And why would you deny them something that you would never deny yourself? So that's one example. But the way to, I think, get the majority to think about the minority in more sympathetic terms is to point out what if you were in that situation? There's a similarity that you might want to think about.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Bruce on the line in Grand Prairie. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just want to state that I've actually spent the past few years myself trying to self-educate myself on politics. And I found that learning about economics, specifically macroeconomics from the left and right spectrum, helped in my understanding of many of the ideological debates. But I also think that one of the reasons that I think there's so much confusion among the population it's because there's certain interest groups that tend to try to obfuscate certain political terms. For example, in American politics, things are usually discussed in terms of liberal or conservative, but those terms usually have different connotations outside the U.S., and many people outside of the U.S. kind of describe our society as more of like a neoliberal society. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Any response to that, Arthur?
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. First I would say, you know, learning economics is really important. And you know, the more Americans who understand things about the economic system, it's important not just for life choices that you make, but for understanding, you know, a lot of things the government has to deal with respect to do we raise taxes, do we lower taxes, do we expand Social Security, contract it, and so forth. So I'd congratulate Bruce on pursuing economics. In terms of liberal conservative, it's really interesting. I think that's a term that political junkies use a lot. But for a lot of Americans, it's not a terribly useful term because when they go to the voting booth, they don't see liberal conservative on the ballot. They see Democrat or Republican. And so a lot of people think about the world that way. In fact, on surveys, when you ask some people who aren't that interested in politics what they think conservative means, they think, well, it means I like to conserve. And that's not the same meaning that we think of like when you watch Fox News or CNN. So I'd agree with Bruce that sometimes the liberal and conservative terms are misleading.
So you make the point very firmly in the book that it can be dangerous for people who are seeking out a civic education to feel as if they are getting their information from someone who is biased. But I'm curious, what do we do about biases of our own that we don't recognize as such? And, you know, we may be seeking out a biased source of information without realizing it.
Yeah. So I think the first point to make is, in politics, everybody is biased. And I mean that in the following way. Politics is not just about facts. Politics is about a clash of values. And while we might be able to use science or history or some other means of inquiry to say what's a fact and what isn't, we could disagree on values permanently. And so when you start to think about who you're getting information from, you might not only want to consider the factual basis, but you might want to think about what are the motives of this person finding the information and delivering it to me. So in politics, a lot of what matters is who people find credible, right? And so oftentimes credibility is associated with having common values. So I would say most people are interested in having information with a certain bias. Where things get problematic is where you ignore the biases or where people misrepresent themselves in terms of having a bias. So, you know, if you're trying to advise, let's say you're trying to advise a young person on which vote they should cast, and maybe, you know, they have many decades of life to look forward to. If you were saying, well, here's the vote that's best for you, but not disclosing that your interests are really short term or your interests are really something that won't affect this young person, that's where politics could get into trouble, because you are saying this information is of value to you, but really it isn't, because you're in different circumstances. But there's no way to avoid biased information. If you want to make effective decisions, however, it's good to try and recognize your own biases and those of the people who are giving you the information.
What do people do if they have very strong feelings about an issue that are not reflected perfectly by one party or the other? For example, I'm thinking about people who are very pro-life but might also be against the death penalty. So the Republican Party isn't a perfect fit and the Democratic Party is not a perfect fit.
Yeah, that is a difficult situation in our political system, because there really isn't a great outlet for them. And it's a numbers problem, right? I mean, many people who are pro-life, you know, also are, you know, have different feelings about capital punishment. So, I mean, there's no short-term political fix to that. If what people want to do over a longer period of time is say, look, there's a certain fundamental set of values that both lead to a particular conclusion on the beginning of life and a particular conclusion on the end of life, and you try to say, you know, this is a fundamental value to society, and if you can find a way to tell that story such that more and more people resonate about it over time, but maybe with that question, maybe years or decades, people realize that, you know, if that's their core commitment, if that's consistent with maybe their faith or something like that, that over time more and more people would demand that, let's say, a pro-life position is bound to a no death penalty position. But that's a case that has to be built. It's just not in our current politics, there really isn't a good option for that type of voter.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Virgil on the line in Dallas now. Hi, Virgil.
How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
As I said before to the person on the phone, I've been studying political science from high school through college, and you get it basically from the fifth grade, and this is what I've come to find out. Those people who recognize politics has everything to do with everything that their lives have to encompass, they pay attention. Those who think, well, politics has nothing to do with me because it's not going to affect me. And I bring that up because in the 1990s, I was having a discussion with with one of my coworkers. He was white. And I told him this. I said, look, you don't understand. Black people are the only people who have to have their voting rights voted on every so often. White people don't. When we get a black president, y'all going to lose your mind. And lo and behold, that's what happened. White people lost their mind. We got to have voter IDs now, but what they knew in the beginning was most older black people over the age of 90, they didn't have birth certificates. The state wasn't issuing them birth certificates. So if you don't pay attention to politics, your rights can get taken, and you have no idea why they got taken.
Virgil, thanks for your call. Arthur, do you want to talk a little bit about that idea that, you know, some people don't feel like politics affects them enough to pay attention?
Yeah, that's a common problem. I want to thank Virgil for his question and his energy. I mean, you know, politics is it's a little bit like, if you like professional sports, You know, by the end of the season, you know, if you take professional football, you know, all but one of the teams end up losing, right? Or they don't make the playoffs, and so people are pretty unhappy. Politics is like that too. People can get really passionate about an issue or not, but at some point decisions are made, and you know, one team loses. And so if your team loses enough of the time, people can choose to walk away from it, particularly since the issues in politics can be pretty emotional. So a lot of people just get frustrated with politics. A lot of other people just, you know, it seems remote to them. I mean, they benefit from the judicial system. They benefit from the military protecting them. They benefit from a system of roads and infrastructure, but they don't attach it to government. They don't think that they just think, well, these are things that we should have. So all of those things contribute to people having a limited interest in government. That's always been the case, which is why, you know, people who are very effective politically, they have a tough job to do. They have to break through the noise and say, listen to constituents, listen and say, I understand your life. I've taken time to figure out what you want. And now I'm going to show you why being interested in politics or supporting this candidate or supporting this policy is essential to the life that you want to lead. And if a campaigner or a civic educator gets that right, they're more likely to have an audience. But you got to take that step of seeing it from the other person's point of view. The eat your spinach approach doesn't really work anymore. I'm not sure it ever really did.
What do we do about elections, sometimes on the local level, that are nonpartisan and therefore don't offer those shorthand cues of political party affiliation?
Yeah, those are harder. So when you're right in presidential elections, you can look at who's a Democrat, who's a Republican, and you can make a choice. In local elections, it's a little better now than it used to be, because in nonpartisan elections, how did you find information out about a candidate like 30 years ago? And it would be their mailer. And if you had a good journalism tradition in your city or town, they could tell you things about the candidates. But there, what people often try to learn from is the local news, if they can get it. Interest group endorsements are also pretty important. So if you have an Elks Club or local Chamber of Commerce or, you know, maybe local religious leaders or something of that nature saying, look, I know a lot about this candidate. Here are the experiences I've had with them. Here's what I know about their effectiveness or their values. Those are the types of things that can act like the traffic lights that we looked for before. So in cities and towns where you have people who are, you know, who are known to be knowledgeable, who are known to have a certain set of values and who will come out and say this candidate or that candidate is better, they can help voters who don't know very much. But lacking that, it's a really hard problem. And it's one of the reasons that turnout rates in local elections tend to be a lot lower than in national elections.
There are people who wonder if they should vote if they're not fully informed, and sometimes they don't have confidence to cast a ballot. What do you say to people who are encouraged often by civic educators to vote regardless, and yet who feel like if they are choosing one candidate over another, it's really just, you know, a shot in the dark?
Yeah. So, well, let me say two things. The first thing is that, you know, if the criterion for voting is that you're fully informed, no one would ever vote. We'd have no voters,
right?
Because there are just so many issues, and there's so many, you know, politics isn't just about the facts of a particular bill. It's hundreds of bills. And politics is not just about what it says on the paper, but how it might affect certain types of people and things of that nature. And no one knows at all. So there's really no fully informed. At the same time, voting is a responsibility, and my vote not only affects me, it affects you. And so there is some responsibility. So I think what I would say to people is, you know, what are the things that you really care about? I'm not going to try and legislate what you care about, but what are the things that you really care about? And can you get enough information to figure out which of these candidates, which of these parties, which of these, you know, propositions are consistent with a set of values that you and maybe your community see as you know, valuable to us in the future? And if you know that, then at some level you've fulfilled your responsibility. And we might disagree on values, right? But that's not something that politics can really legislate. So I think that, for me, that's the advice I'd give.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Matt in Plano. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to echo what the professor's saying about, voters, they only care about one or two issues. And I know that because I've been a candidate for office locally two times. I've also been a campaign manager. What's so frustrating is when you go knock on a door and talk to a voter, like I said, they only care about one issue, but many times it has nothing to do with what you're running. You know, I ran for city council, and they're asking you about what are you going to do about immigration. They have no effect on that. And so, obviously candidates, try to find those one or two hot button issues, but unfortunately it just doesn't have any, either one or two things is happening. Either they know it has nothing to do with why you're running, they just want to know your values, or they really are that misinformed about what the role of local government or whatever you're running for does.
What do you think about that, Arthur?
Well, first, I just want to thank Matt for being a candidate, because the lifeblood of our system are people who are willing to put themselves out there, run for office, be campaign managers, and so forth. So it's a thankless job. People slam doors in your faces. They say not very nice things about you. But without people like the caller, the system would be a lot worse. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is, when people ask a candidate about their values instead of asking about facts, it's a really important question because, at all levels of government, you don't exactly know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to come up or what crisis is going to arise or so forth. And a candidate doesn't know that either. And so they can't really say, well, here's what I would do in this situation. Here's what I'd do in that situation. But if you can articulate your values and people have a sense of what trade-offs you're going to make, you effectively have a lot of that conversation. People can, so you knock on one door and they really care about traffic. And if they understand your values and how you'd make a trade-off on traffic, they learn something. And they maybe, it meets them, it can lead them to cast the same vote they would have cast had they known more. So I think, that question about values is not of secondary importance in politics. That said, on local elections, most people are going to care about one or two things, and they are going to be misinformed about a lot of government. And the people who can be successful in politics, in office, are people who you just have to listen to it. You have to try and understand it and then find a way to use that as your foundation to then tell a story about, well, here's why I can be your elected representative. Here's why I will help you with the types of things you care about. And, if you can tell that story truthfully to enough different types of people, then you can make a real difference in city government.
Political scientist Arthur Lupia is here. He does his research at the University of Michigan and is author of a new book called Uninformed: Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. We have time for more of your calls after this break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Arthur Lupia. He is research professor at the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan and author of a new book called Uninformed: Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. I was thinking, Arthur, about what people do to assess the competency of political leaders or would-be leaders. And we have an email here from Esteban in Lakewood who says there's a saying in politics that goes, if you're explaining, you're losing, meaning there is no place for nuance in a political campaign. Is there any way to get beyond the oversimplification that candidates default to?
Yeah, that's a great question. We live in a different age, and so candidates just can't send one message to everybody anymore. 50 years ago, you had to because there were only one or two newspapers in a town, two or three TV stations, a couple radio stations, so you had to send one message. And so what politicians can do now is to the set of political junkies or geeks or, information wizards, you can send a lot of very complex information about what you're doing. You can be very accountable. And that's done at a lot of levels of government where, budgets are printed online and, reports about kind of police and things of that nature. So there is a lot of nuance for people who want it. Yet when it comes to election time, you're trying not to just to talk to the junkies, but to a broader audience. And at that time, then the contest is, can I somehow represent myself in a way that I won't get ridiculed, but also pitch what I've done or pitch what government has done in a way that resonates with people? And at that point, you're going to have to come up with simplicity, because if you give a nuanced argument, most people are going to tune you out. So again, to your question, I'd say there is an audience for nuance. They're just not the audience that we're often talking to at election times.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Scott is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. You know, last year there was a study that came out. I don't remember from which university, but they determined that the United States is no longer a representative democracy, that it's now a corporate oligarchy, and that it really doesn't matter, you know, what a candidate says or does. It's what the people that or what the entities that give him money or give him or her money are the ones that are going to be listened to. And how does that factor in with all of this?
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, so, you know, money plays a big role in politics, particularly at the national level, and the role has changed after the Citizens United decision. But I would say that money isn't a necessary or sufficient condition for being elected. If you have a lot of money and you can't articulate a message very well, it's very hard to get elected. Governor Bush, for example, from Florida, is having a real hard time with the Republican nomination. I don't know what his current poll numbers are, but they're, I think, 2 or 3%, despite the fact that he started with a huge money advantage. I mean, I think that his campaign and super PACs affiliated with him may have had $150 million, maybe up to 6 months ago. And that was much more money than anybody else had. So if you can't articulate a message that people resonate to, it's very hard to get traction, even if you have money. On the other side, at the presidential level, if you don't have any money, it's really hard to get an audience. But there are so many important laws made at the state level and at the local level and at the county level. And there, most of those campaigns don't have a lot of money attached to them or affiliated with them. And so their skill at, you know, both understanding the law, understanding government, and finding a way to articulate citizens' concerns, it's a way that you can make a big difference. In fact, I would say if you took all the laws that were made in a particular year and threw them into a hat and then drew one out at random, it's very unlikely that you'd pick out a federal law. There's so much going on at the state and local level. So I think that Scott's question about the role of money, I think at the federal level, you could make an argument that money has a very big role. At the state and local level, I think ideas still matter a lot more.
Is it instantly obvious to people, Arthur, what their key issue or issues will be? Or is this a role that civic education can also play, helping people sort of divine what they truly care about to the exclusion maybe of less pressing issues?
Well, one thing I'll say is that, you know, what research shows about this issue is what people care about changes over their lifetime. You know, as a young person, you might care about whether or not there's a draft or whether or not there are job opportunities and things of that nature. You get a little older, you care about infrastructure for children, parks, schools, things of that nature. And then when you get on even a little bit more, you care about, you know, the health system and Social Security. So there are lifespan changes in what people want. But civic education can do a lot of good in trying to help people understand the relationship between the lives that they lead and the actions of government. What are the links? Because people who, like Virgil, I think, was saying before, people who understand that link, they tend to be more involved. And so if civic education can help people see that, it can do a lot better. And I think civic education needs to be better at making that type of argument, and I think it's getting better.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Mary on the line in Garland. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was calling to speak to Chris concerning voting. Mm-hmm. I remember the time my grandmother, she had told me when I was a kid, she said you had to have own land and you had to pay a poll tax to vote.
Yeah.
And now, since the 60s, everybody been able to vote. And now it seems as though they're trying to, keep minorities from voting by asking for a whole lot of things. So I would like to ask Chris his take on that and what does he talk to his civic students about on voting rights.
Thanks for a call, Arthur.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a constant struggle in this country, you know, in the history of this country about who has the vote. It's starting from the, you know, before the Constitution, right? And it still goes on now. You know, on the one hand, people are worried about voter fraud, but I will say that there's very little evidence of it in recent elections. So, you know, how you make voting easy for people, how you open up the process, I think is really important. And I think the legitimacy of elections depends on everyone being able to participate. You know, I think that the real politics of the current situation is I'm not sure that there are a lot of people who want to keep minorities from voting per se. I think it's that there are some people who want to keep minorities from voting because they tend to vote Democratic, right? If minority groups were heavily Republican or if they split 50-50, I think that these restrictions wouldn't seem as racial as they do today. It's a constant struggle. But I think what even people who seem to be trying to restrict the franchise, I think that they can't go too far with those arguments because if we did, people would start questioning the integrity of the elections.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Kyle in Dallas. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, how's it going?
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, I really like this conversation. And actually, I just wanted to make a quick comment. So first off, I'm a gay Republican, and I think that I get a lot of looks from a lot of people in the gay community when I say that, just because there's not so many of us. One thing that I was actually reading on the Huffington Post this morning, my friend sent me a video about, it was an American Dad episode, and it was like a little skit that they did about called Red and Gay or something like that, and I thought it was a really funny video, and I started reading some of the comments below, and Huffington Post obviously leans to the left a bit, and I noticed that there was a lot of people who were commenting saying, oh my gosh, people who support this are so ignorant, and I can't believe that a gay person would do this. Now that the Supreme Court's legalized gay marriage, I feel that there should be a shift, and I feel that we shouldn't be viewed as having that, I guess I should say that one political view should not be affiliated with that party. That's my personal belief, but I do know that we've been talking about that and how people have this idea that they're only concerned with one issue. So I just wanted to make a comment about that and how I thought it was interesting, the correlation between the two. And I'm hoping things will start to change and I won't get ostracized too much.
Well, thanks so much for your call, Kyle. I really appreciate it. Is there anything you want to respond to there, Arthur?
Yeah, first, Kyle, thanks for calling. You know, I think you're right about one source of a likely shift. Like, you know that one part of the Republican Party has a libertarian wing. And the libertarian wing, you know, it was always surprising to me that some Republicans could take such a hard stand on gay marriage when you had libertarians in there. And, you know, if you're a true libertarian, you might say, you know, the government shouldn't be really regulating marriage, right? Or they should be intervening minimally in these types of things. And so now that the Supreme Court decision has come, I think it's going to be a lot easier to have that conversation. The other countervailing factor is that, you know, in the Democratic Party, you still have a pretty strong Catholic element, right? And so, you know, we associate anxieties about gay people sometimes with the right. But in the left, there's a group of people that have anxieties about them as well. And so I think that, you know, it will be easier to be a gay Republican in the future, but I'm not exactly sure how it's going to work out. You know, like in Houston, they just had this vote, and I don't know. I didn't see how it broke down there, but a pro-gay measure I know failed. So I think that the future politics of LGBT are going to be interesting. I would bet that at least for the next 10 or 20 years, it would be easier to be a gay Democrat than a gay Republican. But I think that Kyle will probably have a bigger cohort as the years go on.
Let's talk about civic education in a formalized school setting. People are interested in making sure that our students learn a minimum of information, and what those facts ought to be maybe would vary. But can you talk about what you see as the flaws in the ways that we test students to make sure that they understand political issues enough to allow them to be functioning members of society?
Yeah, so this is what I wanted. I just want to have a caveat first. I don't want to paint civic education in a broad brush because there are a lot of people doing some great things. But what you see happening a lot is, you know, people write tests and build curricula around things they wouldn't be caught dead not knowing. So, you know, I'm a political science professor. If I don't know basic things about government and I walk in front of a group of people, I'm dead. And so many people think, well, this is the information that everybody needs to know. But of course it isn't. You know, there are so many people who get through lives and do wonderful things for society without being able to name a Supreme Court justice or name their senator or so forth. And so I think that so you know, making people learn those types of things and saying that somehow they knowledge of that is essential for being a good citizen, what I show in the book is there is no evidence of that. I mean, it has been often asserted and never actually demonstrated. And so the question now is, what information can you give people? And if you want them to be effective citizens, I think you need a mix of both basic facts about the system and critical thinking skills, because a lot of what politics is about is building coalitions and building ideas and trying to figure out, you know, how do we deal with this new problem or how do we deal with this new situation? When I teach and when I advise people, I often have a mix of kind of traditional learning and then simulations where we put people in the situation of a legislator. We put people in the situation of a campaign manager. We really try and make that situation real and make their grades depend on whether they do well or not. The students that I've had, the people that I've worked with, they respond very well to that. I mean, if you put them in a situation where they have a stake in the outcome. And I will tell you, I get letters every week from people I've taught in the past or groups I've worked with in the past who say, you know, teaching civics in this way, where it's a mix of basic facts, and you put me in the situation where I'm actually like a legislator, they remember it years later, and they're able to use it, and they embrace it. And I think that civic education is moving that way and needs to continue to do so.
For people who have finished with their formal schooling, where do you suggest regular people look for political information in an election year? It seems hard to find substantive information that is presented without any kind of bias.
Yeah, you know, it's it depends on how much time you have. I mean, for people who want to spend a lot of time at this, you know, there are all, you know, NPR, The New York Times, The Economist, they do in-depth reports. And there are, you know, government agencies and nonprofits and NGOs who do even more in-depth reporting about really so many aspects of government. For junkies, there is so much information that's available that there's more than anyone could ever pay attention to. For people who have less time, you know, there are websites that the League of Women Voters has always had a great aggregation website where they'll have lists of candidates in all types of races, even going down to local levels. And they'll have templates where they give you kind of basic facts about party and background and so forth. And it's pretty user friendly. Many times these are regional organizations doing it. A lot of them are on the level and they're treating the Republicans and the Democrats fairly. And so people who want that type of information, I think League of Women Voters is a great source.
So are you bullish on the future of American democracy?
Oh, sure. I mean, I have concerns about, you know, one thing that's changed in the last 10 years is the marketplace for information and the marketplace for meaning. It's so different than anything we've ever discovered before. But I think, and I worry about certain changes in technology driving us apart. But, you know, there are so many great things that this country can do, and there's so many great things that the citizens in this country can do that I am bullish on it. I mean, I think that in the media, we don't pay attention to all the great things that are happening in local government. And if people knew more about that, the actual, you know, blood and sweat and tears that people are putting into building communities, we'd be a lot prouder of it. The media tends to focus on the noise in Washington, but I am bullish on that. I think we've got a lot of really great public servants and people who are committed to society in this country. I think it's one of the best things about it.
Arthur Lupia is professor of political science at the University of Michigan and author of Uninformed: Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Arthur, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.